Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. In the Vatican, on Friday 19th of February, Benedict XVI announced the date for the canonization of six men and women. 17th of October 2010. Let's listen to him as he pronounces that date in Latin.
Die decima septima octobris anno bis millesimo decimo in sanctorum album referantur.
Among these six to be canonized is one of particular interest to our Australian listeners. She's Mary of the Cross, Blessed Mary MacKillop.
Maria Cruce MacKillop.
But why not find out more about this saint to be? Stay tuned. Since 1958, Sister Maria Casey belongs to the Congregation of the Sisters of Saint Joseph of the Sacred Heart, or Josephites as her order is more popularly referred to across Australia today. In recent years, Sister Maria's dedicated most of her time to the cause for the canonization of her foundress, Mary MacKillop, who, as you may remember, was beatified in 1995 by Pope John Paul II. A celebration, this canonization, which will take place in Rome, as Pope Benedict himself announced on Friday here in the Vatican, marks a day when Australians can proudly say they too have a saint. One who may have lived at the end of the 19th century, but whose do-good legacy is still very much alive today, over a century later. Earlier in the week, I invited Sister Maria, who, as you may have gathered, is postulator for the cause of the canonization of Mary MacKillop, to sit down with me here in our studios, in an effort to help me, and you of course, better understand what the special charism of this woman who founded her congregation might be.
She had an extraordinary personality, but she also had this gift of loving God intensely. And then out of that love for God, she loved, as it tells us in the Gospel, she loved her neighbour. Catholic education was her first endeavour for poor children in Australia of the time, because at that period, Australia was about 50 years of white settlement and things were very harsh. And the Catholics were quite discriminated against, and especially rural Catholics. So she started by helping those very outback children, and then she went on to other works of mercy, like taking care of prostitutes when they wanted to change their way of life and get them other work, women coming out of prison, the sick and the elderly who had no one to take care for them. So she had a very broad range of what we would call social services in an age when there were no social services by the state or by the government.
Yes, I thought to myself, at a time when there were no social services, this lady donning her brown religious habit must have cut somewhat of a remarkable figure as she attended to the needs of the down and outs in the Australian outback. But I wondered how, while putting into practice the Christian message with so much awareness of the marginalised and so much dedication, she got to ruffle so many feathers, to the point, believe it or not, of being excommunicated. I put that question to Sister Maria. How did she get to be excommunicated?
It was a long story, but her founder was Father Julian Tennyson Woods. And he had problems with the other clergy in Adelaide, and so she was seen to be also part of the problem. There were difficulties with the funding of schools, and what was even more interesting was she wanted a new form of, or a new type of religious, who would be accountable to a mother superior and free to go wherever there was a need around Australia or elsewhere. That was unheard of in Australia at that period and in many other parts of the world. And bishops individually were usually in charge of the religious women who lived in their diocese. And it was only beginning to be accepted that women could take charge of their own congregations, and so she had difficulties with the clergy. She also reported a priest who was sexually abusing his altar boys, and his best friend took umbrage and was not very charitable in his reports to the bishop about her and her sisters and their work. So there was a whole complex combination of factors. And the final straw that broke the camel's back was that the bishop wanted her to go back to the country, and this particular priest was sent to give her the message, and she said to him, "I cannot go until I see the bishop." But he reported back, "Your Lord, she refuses to go." And, of course, then the bishop got upset and decided on the excommunication.
So she was a very determined woman. She didn't shy away from difficulties.
No, she did not. And, of course, I should mention that the excommunication was illegal and invalid in terms of canon law at the time.
So after the excommunication was lifted, she went to Rome to meet with the Pope, who was then Pius IX.
Yes. The bishop who excommunicated her died just after he removed the excommunication ban from her. And the new bishop advised her then to come to Rome and get the approval of the Pope for the way of life that she wanted and that Julian Tennyson Woods wanted.
Clearly, Pope Pius IX's approval made Mary MacKillop's mission back home from impossible to possible. She could now go back to her work both in the field of education and within that world of the society's down and outs, among whom I imagine she would have had, at heart, a specific group of people. I requested confirmation from Sister Maria. What about the whole Aboriginal question in Australia? Was she involved in helping the Aboriginals?
She was. Before she founded the congregation, she was governess to her uncle's children, and she used to take the Aboriginal children of the people who worked on the property and taught them how to read and write. And I was at a reunion just 2 years ago, and the descendants of those children came and were very, very proud of the fact that they were descended from those children that she helped. She also tried very, very hard to start a foundation in the northwest of Western Australia, but each time something mitigated against her and she wasn't able to do that. So it wasn't until the 1960s that we had a specific mission to the north of West Australia, but around each of the major cities, the sisters always taught the Aboriginal children and also in some of the remote rural areas. So we've had, since the 60s especially, a very big involvement with the Aboriginal people in the remote settlements and in the desert.
Which means that the sisters had a particular way of life in the sense that they were kind of nomadic and living
yes.
in different places.
That's right. And that was her purpose, that the sisters would go where the need was. And sometimes when the mining, for instance, was in full swing, the big mining boom in Australia, they lived in tents and then they would move with the people to the next place. Or if it developed as a centre, then they would get a house similar to whatever the people lived in. They didn't ever live in large convents.
She was a very modern woman for her age, no?
She was, yes.
She was very forward-looking.
She was, and very much a woman of the people. She didn't see that the sisters should be better or not as good as, but that they were with the people and were one with the people that she worked with.
Am I right in thinking that she didn't have a very high level of education?
Not a formal education, but her father had been a seminarian in Rome for many years, and he gave her a lot of education. As well as that, she attended school when she could, and she had private tutoring as well. So in one sense, not a lot of formal education, because it wasn't available where she was. And they also moved house a great deal. But in another sense, she was highly educated, especially in faith and in her religious requirements.
Once canonized, she'll become the first saint for Australia, no?
Yes, yes. And we say the first recognized saint because we know that there are thousands of saints in all walks of life in all countries. So we have to say it's the first recognized saint. Yes.
I think you have about 900 sisters today and plenty of lay people attached.
Yes, women and men. And we have different groups. We have one very large group called associates. Sometimes they will work with the sisters. Sometimes it's a prayer group and that they will pray for the works of the sisters and lend their support in that way. We have groups of young people who will volunteer for short periods and will become what's called the Josephite Community Aid. And they will work intensively, perhaps for 1 year, for 2 years, sometimes.
Is this a recent development?
Or? Fairly recent, yes.
It didn't stem from Mary MacKillop, this development.
No, but they live her charism in the modern world. And then we have other groups of women who don't want to live the religious life in the way that we do, but they would want to take vows and live her way of life as seculars in the world.
The picture seemed to come more clearly into focus for me. I could tell this Saint B has become a role model for Catholics in Australia, but possibly, I assumed, not just Catholics. So I asked Sister Maria whether this was the case.
She's very much loved because in her lifetime she was also unique in that amongst her friends of those days she had Presbyterians, Anglicans, Jews. That was unusual for Catholics in those days to intermix with peoples of other religions. So there is great love and respect for her amongst the other religions and the people of no religion. They have great respect for her. And actually, just recently, a Muslim principal of a school was telling me of his interest, and he brings his students to her tomb every year and to the museum that tells of her life history, and is very anxious to be involved in the celebrations when it comes. So, and in the media at the moment are intensely interested, and she seems to speak to everybody.
Tell me a little bit about first the beatification process and then the canonization. You're now the postulator,
yes.
But you followed this process ever since?
Well, I've followed it intensely early in the piece, but I've been officially involved since 2001. And I became the vice postulator to Father Paul Gartner, who was then the postulator. And the process was introduced in 1925 and began in 1926 and was interrupted about 1931 and for all sorts of reasons, and then was taken up again in 1951. And from then on, there are several phases. There's a phase in the diocese and then a second phase in Rome that leads up to the beatification, and then we repeat the same two again. And for beatification, they had to interview anyone who knew her and take their testimony under oath, then examine all her writings to see that there were no heresies or theological errors. And when all of that was collected in the diocese and that the local bishop had said, yes, the theologians had examined it, it was sent to Rome. And that phase, then the cause was then officially introduced. And then the postulator of the day had to write what's called the position paper, which summarised her life, looked at her virtues, and looked at whether or not she was a holy woman. And when all of that was done, they examined a cure as the basis of a miracle. And eventually the green light was given and she was beatified.
Mm-hmm. And what was the miracle?
The miracle was the cure of a lady with acute leukaemia who didn't have much time
to Australia?
In Australia. And that was nearly 60 years ago, and she's still living.
And that's what I discovered about this feisty woman of migrant stock who lived an extraordinary life at an extraordinary time of harshness in the development of the Australian colonies. A holy woman, renowned for her kindness and gentleness, who died in 1909 in the presence of the Cardinal Archbishop of Sydney, who said at the time, "This day I have attended the deathbed of a saint." That's what Sister Maria Casey remarked to me, adding, 85 years on, we finally have that official recognition of the sanctity of Mary MacKillop. And warm thanks there to the postulator for the cause for the canonization of Blessed Mary MacKillop, Sister Maria Casey, of the Congregation of the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.